You are listening to another Voice of Freedom broadcast, financed through the free will donations of listeners like yourself. I'm Ernst Sundl, your host and moderator. The opinions expressed by our guests or in editorials and stories are always those of the originators. We believe that personal opinions freely expressed are not a danger to any democratic society. We don't have to agree with any or all of the opinions expressed by others. We owe it to ourselves, however, to listen, to evaluate, and to possibly learn something new or different in the process. You may reach us at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1, telephone 1-416-922-9850. And now we have another interesting program for you. I'm Ernst Sundl with another Voice of Freedom program. A number of our listeners from around the country, and some even as far away as Europe, have contacted us about our recent programs relating to D-Day and the period in Europe after D-Day, and some of our revisionist viewpoints that we hold on this topic. Well, some of them complained that I, in my programs, had not spelled out in more detail what the Second World War was all about and how it came about. So let me try to give it a layman's overview. Nothing academic, just a layman's overview. The Germans in the First World War were defeated by a coalition of forces, and the German government under the Weimar Republic was asked to sign a treaty in Versailles. And one of the stipulations of that treaty was that the Germans had to declare themselves solely responsible for the First World War. And of course, with the loss of Germany's territories in the East, coupled with this slap in the face for the entire German nation, who knew that they had not been solely responsible for this tragedy, which was the First World War, this meant there was a fertile soil for nationalists, or even extreme nationalists, to agitate against the existing order of things. Germany, you must understand, was under some form of Allied tutelage, was under military occupation in some regions. Germany was condemned to pay reparations, huge amounts of reparations, which were to only run out in the year 1988. I want to repeat that. These massive billions of dollars worth of gold marks of reparations the Germans were to pay to the Allies were to be running till the year 1988. That was reparations the Germans had to pay for the First World War. The reason why I'm stressing that is because, of course, it bankrupted the German nation, led to hyperinflation, where people were paid three times a day, mornings, noon, and night, because the money devalued between breakfast and lunch, sometimes by millions of marks. And so when men were receiving their paycheck, they didn't go and bring a wallet at the end of the week. They usually brought a basket. And finally, some of the store and shop owners paid their people every single evening because hyperinflation was running away with the currency in Germany. My own mother, a very simple young girl, said that she worked for a whole month, and at the end of the month, all she could buy with her earnings for that month in 1923 was a stamp with which to send a postcard to her parents. That is what the situation was. In that situation, Adolf Hitler, a very gifted young orator in Germany, started his struggle for power. And he struggled against those who had signed this shameful treaty in Versailles and against those who had imposed it on Germany. And he found increasing resonance amongst the German population at first, the working people, finally an ever-increasing number amongst Germany's students, then amongst the more middle classes, and finally even amongst the intelligentsia, meaning professors, doctors, dentists, lawyers, and so on. And Adolf Hitler democratically moved into the Reichstag, and because his party was the party that had garnered most votes in a coalition with other nationalist forces, finally became the government of Germany in 1933 on the 30th of January. While Hitler was struggling for power, he had said over and over in thousands of speeches and talks and articles in his party newspaper and so on, and many of his members of parliament, the Reichstag at that time, said to the German population, understand that a vote for National Socialism does not mean a change of government in Germany. In other words, it's not a change of administration. It's not the Democrats being replaced by the Republicans, or in the Canadian context, the Liberals replacing the Conservatives. He said, what you are doing with this election, it is a plebiscite on which way Germany is going to go. In other words, there are going to be some fundamental changes in German society, and he had outlined them to the German population quite openly and quite freely, what he thought Germany should look like in the 1930s. The Germans were not sucked into or conned into voting for yet another politician who had made all kinds of promises that he wasn't going to keep. My own mother and my own father, who had been unemployed for 4 years by the time Adolf Hitler finally did come to power, said that they had tried the Conservatives, they had voted for the Catholic Party, the Christian Center Party, they had even voted for the Social Democratic Party. Other Germans, disgusted by all this party wrangling, voted for the Communist Party. And there was a polarization of political opinion and political action and the political spectrum in Germany in the 1930s between the extreme left and, yes, the extreme nationalist right. Hitler represented the right, the forces of the right, and together with a number of smaller parties, finally did form the government, as I said. And he was hardly in power when an international boycott was called against Germany. And the reason why I'm mentioning this is because in the next few programs, we're going to take a look exactly at what happened in Nazi Germany, the way the popular press calls it, or National Socialist Germany, in Hitler's Germany, after he came to power. Let me just say to you that in studying this period of time, I found that Germany was in a terribly shocking state. And that, for instance, in the state of Thuringia, which is in the east, the budget for social welfare was 2/3 of the state's budget was eaten up by social welfare. 2/3. You can imagine, that means so many people were unemployed, were on the dole, were half employed, and so on. A state cannot function with this kind of budget. And so a crisis was looming large in Germany. Also, the foreign currency reserves of Germany had gone down to such a level that when the German economics minister mentioned this to the new government, Hitler was alarmed. It was down to some 480 million marks, which for a trading nation like Germany that depended on financing exports and so on, it was virtually the death knell. Germany was to all intents and purposes bankrupt. How to get out of this situation was what dominated the mind of the new government. And during this particular time, there were rumors around the world that there were going to be preventive wars. There was going to be an invasion of Germany, either by France or by Poland, or by both governments. Now, at the time, these two countries were, in a European context, superpowers. You must understand that the Treaty of Versailles condemned the German government to a force of professional soldiers of 100,000 people, just 100,000 men. That meant the entire German armed forces could fit into the Berlin soccer stadium. Now picture that, the Berlin soccer stadium. The only weapons that they had were machine guns. When they were practicing with tanks, they were bicycles with cardboard cutouts made to look like tanks. Because Germany was the only totally disarmed country, and it was forced to disarm under the Treaty of Versailles. Hitler had all, he knew all this. In other words, he was in absolutely no position to threaten anybody. Others were threatening his government. And suddenly there were these news from North America that the Jewish community in North America was calling for an international boycott against Germany. It was a man called Samuel Untermeyer who had gone to Amsterdam for a conference. And when he returned to the United States, he gave a nationally broadcast radio program in which he called for a holy war against Germany, a national boycott. And naturally, Hitler's ambassadors and consular officials reported that back to Germany, so did the media. Hitler was alarmed. Here was the threat of military invasion, economic strangulation. Inside Germany, the communists were restive, and so Hitler did what other German chancellors had done before him, perfectly democratic measure, to call out some kind of an emergency measures act. In Canada, we would call it the War Measures Act. Into this period fell a fire that was started by apparently a communist or a man with communist leanings called van der Lubbe, who tried to burn down the Reichstag, meaning the German parliament, apparently as some kind of a note to other leftists to start simultaneously all over Germany similar activities and to try to have an overthrow of the German government. Now, I know that in Allied propaganda, Hermann Göring is supposedly himself having carried a canister of gasoline through some secret tunnels into the Reichstag, and he's supposed to have had a kind of a hand in burning down the Reichstag. Well, perfectly independent people and historical commissions and inquiries by independent historians during, before, during, and after the war have come to the conclusion that in effect the Nazis did not torch the Reichstag, that it was a canard put out by communist and leftist propaganda. Hitler used this as his means of introducing draconian repressive measures inside Germany, outlawing political parties, political movements, arrest without habeas corpus, and so on. It was a typical emergency measure act. Now, I want you immediately to understand, this is not to excuse Adolf Hitler and him breaking the civil rights of Germans. I am just trying to explain to you that this is nothing new in European history, certainly absolutely nothing new of the period. And in Canada, as late as 1972, we had what they called the invoking of the War Measures Act. Actually, it was earlier still during the FLQ crisis, the Front de Libération Québécois, which was a leftist group that was blowing up mailboxes, the stock market building, and so on. And the Canadian government, in perfect peacetime, prosperous, not surrounded by enemies that were trying to invade our country here, imposed the War Measures Act. I lived there during the time in Quebec, and I can assure you, here is what happened. Hundreds, many, many, many hundreds of French-Canadian activists who had been politically vocal in wanting to have separation between Quebec and the rest of the country were rounded up at night, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and they were arrested without any legal representation. They were put into sports arenas, meaning concentrated into the same kind of area that Hitler would take his dissidents and so on in the early 30s. They were kept in there, some of them were kept in jails in Canada without having the rights that we normally have to be brought before a judge speedily and so on, because the War Measures Act had declared a national emergency, saying that there was imminent danger to the survival of Canada as a society and as a state, and then your civil rights went out the window. Well, that's exactly what happened to Germans in the Hitler era as soon as Adolf Hitler came to power, because there was this perceived threat to the German state, the overthrow of the German government, and Hitler invoked what he called the Enabling Act, where he spelled out what his moves were going to be. And so, Germany that moment became somewhat of a dictatorship. True, there were elections and there were plebiscites later on, But ultimately, Hitler governed Germany under this kind of draconian enabling legislation, which allowed him to forbid parties and movements and seize newspapers, outlaw publishing houses and stuff like this, very much the way the West German state has been doing in the last 6 to 7 months. And again, Germany has no threat of invasion. Germany has no threat that the state is going to be overthrown. Yet the ruling clique in power in Germany says, oh, we have got political dissidents here that are getting entirely too testy. They're having these big marches of 4, 5, 10,000 people. Our police forces can no longer control them, meaning they cannot cow them into silence. And even 10,000 policemen last fall could not prevent a march in honor of Rudolf Hess, for instance. And so therefore, we are going to pass this draconian legislation, which they tried to do recently on the 20th of June with their what they call crime bill. But the German parliament at that time, the upper house at least, voted down this draconian law. Well, in Hitler's Germany, they did not, because National Socialism at that time, as I said, had the superior numbers. And so Germany began to rebuild under those measures with limited freedoms, restricted freedom of expression, and Hitler managed by all kinds of means, which we are going to cover in future programs, to prevent the invasion by France and by Poland, to prevent the boycott from crippling and destroying the German economy. And Adolf Hitler and his government went on and governed Germany in peacetime for another 6 years. And by the year 1936, we are able already to absorb all the millions and millions of unemployed in Germany and the surrounding countries. 2 million people worked as guest workers in Germany in 1937 and 38, at a time when the rest of Europe was, and America, may I say, and Canada, was still very much suffering under a depression. Hitler's Germany was like a beautifully tended garden surrounded by a bunch of gardens full of weeds. And of course, the envy of the people who tilled the gardens, meaning the governments of the particular day, was rife everywhere. Not the people. For instance, Hitler had this program where he was going to send hardworking miners and farmers and so on these cruise ships to distant places in North Africa, in Egypt, in Greece, or in Norway. And it was such a hit with the working people of Europe that ordinary people could actually go on cruises that England forbade the landing of these German cruise ships in British ports. Because rather than giving their own working people such a break, they found it much easier just to restrict German ships from landing and not getting British workers envious. What I'm saying to you is, Hitler made Germany prosper. He made the trains run on time. Things hummed in Germany. Germany broke all kinds of records on the ground, in the air, with cars, with planes. National Socialist Germany in peacetime was a progressive, thriving country. And the people that lived there during that particular time apparently allowed this restricted freedom that they couldn't have different opinions and so on. They traded social security, financial security, bread and butter stuff over freedom. It has always troubled me that that's the way it was, but that's the way it was. I personally am far more of a believer in individualism and freedom than that the particular generation, but the Germans, after all, if the majority does rule by their majority and by constantly reaffirming Hitler in power and his government, decided that was the way they were perfectly willing to live. Who am I to say in 1994 that they didn't have the right to do that? Now, why did the war break out? Because apparently Hitler was a sworn enemy of Marxism, communism, then called Bolshevism. And Europe had these Bolshevik uprisings, especially in Hungary, Romania, also in the East, especially in Russia, where a lot of blood was spilled, where hundreds of thousands, millions we know today, tens of millions of people were butchered in the most gruesome way, worked to death in the gulag, worked to death while building canals through mosquito-infested swamps and so on. Today, now that the archives are open and the mass graves are being found in the Crimea and in the Ukraine and in Russia proper, mass graves that hold 200, 240,000, 300,000 people, and we have only just scratched the surface. So, the Bolsheviks, who were in the East, armed to the teeth, had always said that they believed in world revolution. You know, and they were appealing to the workers around the world in uprising after uprising. I know I've got a book in my bookshelves here about a communist uprising in Brazil. Then we had the communist uprising in Spain. It was known at that time in Europe that communism was a huge threat to Western values and Western civilization. Adolf Hitler was a strong opponent of Marxism. He considered it almost like an evil religion. And when President Ford, and later on, much more so, President Reagan and President Nixon before them, had certain anti-communist statements made, President Reagan was the one that coined the phrase, the evil empire. Well, let me tell you, Adolf Hitler had called Bolshevism and the Soviet Union an evil empire already in 1920s, and had initiated policies to contain the evil empire in the late 1930s, making what he called the Anti-Comintern Pact with Italy, Japan, and Germany. And he also knew from his intelligence services that Russia, armed to the teeth as they were pulling together troops at the eastern border. And so he knew that they were going to attack Germany and Western Europe. How did he know? Because the German armed forces and the German spy system against communism worked. They had lots and lots of ethnic Europeans in the East who were siding with the German government. And so their information was excellent. But when Hitler finally ended up in this terrible tragedy with Poland, which France and England used as a declaration, as the reason for a declaration of war against Germany, Hitler knew that he had to quickly finish the Continental Powers in a kind of a preemptive quick strike in order to keep his back free, because he knew that the Soviet Union was arming and ready and rearing to go and invade Germany from the east. Germany didn't have enough land, enough depth, geopolitically speaking, geographically speaking, to absorb the massive invasion forces which were then beginning to build up on her eastern frontier. And so, luckily for Germany, France was subdued quickly, Holland and Belgium also, and Hitler could now turn his attention to the east. By now, his air force, using the very latest in technology, high-altitude planes, quite similar to the later, the very famous U-2 spy planes, which Francis Gary Powers used to fly over the Soviet Union. Hitler had similar planes, not quite as sophisticated, of course, but he could penetrate with his reconnaissance airplanes flying at tremendously high altitudes, for the first time using pressurized cabins, way into the heartland of Russia. How do we know it? Because we have books about it. One man has been on my mailing list for 3 decades. His name is George Pemler. George Pemler, P-E-M-L-E-R. He has written a book called The Flight to the Don River. Der Flug zum Don, published by Drüffel Publishing House in Germany, in which he details and shows with all kinds of photographs the massive build-up of Soviet forces on the German border. And so, Hitler knew that he was not strong enough to just merely defend himself against Russia, and so they decided to preemptorily strike at the build-up of the Soviet forces, very much the way Israel did in a repeat policy, and many people said, using a copycat plan against the Arab world in 1967, with exactly the same results. The Israelis attacked airfields in Egypt, in Syria, and in other places, in Jordan, destroying the planes on the ground. They attacked missile batteries, destroying them on the ground. And once they were silenced, then the ground forces, Israel's tank forces, could sweep through the desert, driving the Arab forces before them into the desert. And ultimately, Israel scored a stunning defeat in a very, very short war called the Six-Day War. Hitler's forces did exactly the same thing in 1941 in the East. And the German Air Force, that was opposed by over 14,000 Soviet planes, knocked down over 12,500 planes or bombed them on the ground within the first 2 weeks of the war. The German Air Force at that time had less than 3,750 planes. The same could be said for ground forces, tank forces, and so on. It was not German massive armor that won this. It was superior German generalship and planning. And also the elan, the spirit of the German troops. However, they were unable to deliver a knockout blow against the Soviet Union, which the world had expected. Basically, we know today, because of treason in German ranks. Treason was the reason for Hitler not winning the war against the Soviet Union. And this is why Germany got stuck in the East. And this is why these huge battles of attrition in Stalingrad, where over 300,000 German men marched into Stalingrad and where only 6,000 of them came back after the Second World War from Stalin's gulag. 96,000 prisoners were taken, about 90,000 of them vanished. And you wonder why there were so few planes, so few troops, so few tanks in the West. Well, I tell you, they were in the East, defending Europe, Western Europe, against the Soviet onslaught, against the hordes of the evil empire, as President Reagan would have called it. And so, Europe's men, we have to remember that, the Hungarians, the Slovakians, the many Polish volunteers, Ukrainian volunteers, Danish, Dutch volunteers. Alone in Denmark, four times as many people were serving in the SS and the German armed forces of Danish nationality than were serving in the Danish armed forces and police. It's an incredible statistic which very few people know. So Hitler's Germany was defending Europe's interest in the East. And this is why the Allies had such an easy time in the West. This is why there were only 270 operational tanks and only 375 planes to meet the Allies' 12,000 planes in the West. They were bleeding to death in the East for Europe. And so, look at it in the context of a German or of Germany. The Germans defended Europe and European-style civilization against Soviet Bolshevism. And so, this was the reason that I should have given you before we went into Normandy. However, the next series of programs that you're going to hear have to do largely with Israel and German-Jewish relations. And I think it is timely because very, very little has been said about this period in history and the German side of it. I am Ernst Zündel, speaking for the Voice of Freedom. Yes, I am a son of the Germans, using the facilities of North American radio stations and the freedom guaranteed to me by the United States Constitution and by the Canadian Bill of Rights, or the other way around, to bring you dissident or different information. And all I'm asking you is, you don't have to believe me, just open up your mind to our German viewpoint and our German side. We are located at 206 Carlton Street in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Our postal code is M5A2L1. Our telephone, 416-922-9850. Thank you very much. Ernst Zündel here, thanking you for your support.